Harry, you're dealing with serious pressures here, with something that could change who you are. I don't blame you for being afraid. I've got the winter night thing under control, I said. Winter night, Mab, whatever, she said, as if it were an everyday annoyance. Magic stuff. You deal with it, fine. I'm talking about something real. I'm talking about Maggie. Oh, I said. I figure it'll take Thomas at least 10 minutes to fuel the boat, she said. It's been about 5 since he left, which gives you 5 minutes with no city to save, no evil queens, and no monsters. No one to protect right in front of you, no apprentices to look strong for. I looked at her blankly and felt my shoulders sag. I hadn't slept in too long. I wanted to find a nice bed somewhere and pull the covers over my head. What are you looking for here? What do you expect from me? She stepped closer and took my hand. Talk to me. Why didn't you go see Maggie? I bowed my head and let my fingers stay limp. I can't. I just can't. Why not? I tried to speak and couldn't. I shook my head. Karen stepped closer to me and took my other hand in hers, too. I'm right here, she said. What if, I whispered, what if she remembers? Remembers what? She was there, I said. She was there when I cut her mother's throat. I don't know if she was conscious, if she saw, but what if she did? In my head, I've run this scenario about 1,000 times, and if she saw me and started screaming or crying, I shrugged, that would be hard. You know what's going to be harder? Karen asked quietly. What? Not knowing. She shook my hands gently. Leaving a hole in that little girl's life. She's your daughter, Harry. You're the only dad she's ever going to have. Yeah, but if I show up and she remembers me, I'm not her father. I'm her father, the monstrous villain. I'm Darth Dresden. She'll learn better, Murphy said, eventually, if you try. You don't understand, I said quietly. I can't. I can't do anything that might hurt her. I just can't. I barely know that little girl, but she's mine. And I'd rather double kneecap myself with a frying pan than bring her an ounce of pain. Pain passes, Karen said. If you think about it, you don't get it, I half snarled. She's blood, Karen. She's mine. Thinking has no place in this. She's my little girl. I can't see her get hurt again. I stopped suddenly with my mouth hanging open. Hell's bells. How could I have missed what the mothers were trying to tell me? I couldn't bear to see my child in pain. And maybe I wasn't the only one who couldn't. Stars and stones, I breathed. That's what's happening here. Karen blinked up at me several times. Excuse me? I kept thinking about it, following the logic. That's why Mab sent me to kill Maeve. She's no different from Titania. She knew it needed to be done, but what? Karen asked. Maeve is still her little girl, I said quietly. Mab isn't human, but there are remnants in all the she. Mother Winter called Mab a romantic. I think this is why. Mother Summer went on and on about how humans have influenced the she. That's what this whole thing is about. I don't understand, Karen said. Mab loves her daughter, I said simply. She won't kill Maeve because she loves her. I let out a bitter little laugh. And there's a kind of symmetry here that the fairies are crazy about. I killed the last summer lady. It's only fitting that the same hand deal with the winter lady. My brain was running along with my mouth, and I stopped talking so that I could poke at the logic of the theory that my instincts, or maybe my heart, told me was obviously true. If Mab wasn't out to wreck the world, if she hadn't been taken by the adversary, then someone else had been lying to me. Someone who shouldn't have been able to lie.
Okay, Karen said. If not Mab, then who is going to pull off this apocalypse ritual magic?
I kept following the lines of logic and felt myself grow abruptly cold. Oh. Oh, God. All this time. I turned and started for the door. Outsiders. At the end of the day, this is all about the outsiders. We've got to go, right now.
Harry? Karen said.
I turned to face her.
Why won't you explain?
She frowned.
You don't trust me.
So you're going to keep me close, just like the others? I looked down at the floor. Don't take it hard. I don't trust myself right now. She shook her head.
This is the thanks I get.
It's Halloween, I said. It's the night when everyone looks like something that they aren't. I turned toward the door. But I'm about to start ripping off masks, and we'll both see where everyone stands. Come on.
Chapter 40. I had a word with Toot Toot once we were outside, and by the time the Munstermobile rolled out of the lot, we had a ring of tiny, nigh-invisible escorts pacing us, making it their business to dislodge any enemy tiny observers our foes might have sent to keep tabs on us. It didn't make me think that we would avoid the attentions of enemy little folk altogether, but every little thing I could conceal from the people working against me could prove to be a critical edge. Karen saw the car's paint job again, rolled her eyes, and declined my offer of a ride. She followed us on her Harley. Molly rode shotgun with me, holding her backpack on her lap. Molly was a big believer in shaping the future by way of carrying anything you might need in a backpack. Tonight it looked particularly stuffed. As I drove, the burn in my calf continued every time I worked the clutch or pumped the brake, getting slowly worse beneath the layers of gauze Butters had wrapped it in. The rest of my lower leg was tingling and itching, too, but at least the wound wasn't soaking through the bandages. What the hell had that dart been? Why plug me with it unless the red cap thought it would kill me?
Molly said as I pulled the caddy into the marina parking lot. I got you something.
Huh? I asked.
I had them rush it out this morning and we got it this afternoon. I mean, you know, as long as I was using Thomas's card anyway.
You embezzled funds from the White Court to get me a present?
I like to think of it less as embezzling and more as an involuntary goodwill contribution, she said.
Careful, I told her. You don't want to get entangled with Lara and her crew. Even owing them money isn't smart.
I didn't borrow it, boss. I stole it. If they weren't cautious enough to stop me, that isn't my problem.
They should be more careful who they hand these cards to. Besides, they can afford it.
The entitled younger generation, I swear, I said. Well done. I found a space big enough for the Munstermobile and parked, then set the emergency brake and killed the engine.
What is it?
Molly got out of the car.
Come see.
I started to, but she hurried impatiently around to meet me, digging into her backpack. I shut the car door behind me, and she presented me with a paper-covered package tied with string. I opened it by tearing paper and snapping string, and a long leather garment unrolled. Molly sang the opening riff from Bad to the Bone. I felt myself smiling and held up a long coat of heavy black leather, like one of those old cowboy dusters, except for the long mantle hanging down over its shoulders. It smelled like new leather and shone without a scuff mark to be seen.
"Where the hell did you find an Inverness coat?" I asked her. "Internet," she said. "Security guy helped me shop for it."
"You don't know his name?" I asked.
"His name is Guy, and he's building security," Molly said. "Security Guy."
"And he did this for you, why?" I asked.
"Because I'm pretty, and because he might have gotten a gift certificate out of the deal."
"Remind me never to give you one of my credit cards," I said, and I put the coat on. The weight of the leather settling around me was familiar and comforting, but this coat wasn't the same as my old coat. The sleeves were a little longer and fit better. The shoulders were a little narrower and actually matched up with mine. The mantle hung down a bit more. The pockets were in a slightly different place. Most significantly, it didn't have the layers of protective enchantments that took about half a working week to lay down. But, yeah, I decided, I could get used to it. I looked up to see my apprentice grinning widely. I put my hand on her shoulder for a moment, smiled, and said, "Thanks, Malls." Her eyes shone. Mouse piled out of the car and hurried over to sniff the coat, tail wagging. "What do you think?" I asked him. "Woof," he said seriously.
"He thinks it suits you," Molly said, smiling.
"Goofy motorcycle cowboy meets Scotland Yard," Mouse wagged his tail. I grunted as Karen pulled in and parked her Harley far down the row from the Munstermobile in a motorcycle parking space. She eyed me as she came walking up to us, then Molly, and gave her an approving nod.
"That's more like it," she said.
"Feels good," I said. I nodded toward the water, where the water beetle was chugging slowly back into its berth. Thomas was at the wheel, maneuvering the tub deftly. I waved at him, and he replied with a thumbs-up gesture. The boat was ready to go. I turned to speak to the others, but before I could, I felt my concentration disrupted. An eerie, cool frisson rolled down my spine, all the way down my body to my legs. There was a flicker and a chill from the little wound, and the pain became a little less. At the same moment, I sensed the air grow a fraction of a degree colder, something I would never have noticed on my own. Sundown. "That's it," I said a second later. "Sun's down. It's on."
"What if you're too late?" Sarissa asked. "What if they're starting right now?"
"Then we're wasting time talking about it," Molly said. "Let's get to the boat." She beckoned Mac and Sarissa. "This way, please." I glanced at Mouse and jerked my chin toward Molly. He heaved himself up and went after her, walking just behind our two unknown quantities. Karen had opened a storage compartment on her Harley. She shrugged out of her jacket and then slipped into a tactical harness and clicked it shut around her. She added a number of nylon pouches to it, then took out a gym bag and dropped heavy objects in before shutting the compartment and locking it. She looked up at me and nodded.
"All set?"
"I miss my gear," I said. "P90 in there?"
"His name is George," Karen said. "You want my backup gun?"
"Nah, I've already got the finest killing technology 1866 had to offer on the boat. Glad I didn't name it George. How embarrassing would that have been?"
"George isn't insecure," she said.
"What about,
the swords?"
"The swords."
"No,"
Karen said.
"Why not?"
She frowned and then shook her head.
"This isn't their fight."
"That doesn't make any sense," I said.
"I've wielded one," she said, "and it makes perfect sense to me. To use them tonight would be to make them vulnerable. No." "But," I began. "Harry," Karen said. "Remember the last time the swords went to the island? When their actual adversaries were there? Remember how that turned out?"
My best friend, Molly's dad, had been shot up like a Tennessee speed limit sign. The swords had a purpose, and as long as they kept to it, they were invulnerable, and the men and women who wielded them were avenging angels. But if they went off mission, bad things tended to happen.
"Trust me," Karen said quietly. "I know it doesn't make sense. Sometimes faith is like that. This isn't their fight. It's ours."
I growled. "Fine, but tell the Almighty that he's missing his chance to get in on the ground floor of something big." Murphy punched my chest, but gently, and smiled when she did it. The two of us turned toward the dock and began to follow Molly and the others. I was just about to step out onto the dock when I heard something. I stopped in my tracks and turned. It started low and distant, a musical cry from somewhere far away. It hung in the darkening air for a moment, like some carrion bird over dying prey, and then slowly faded. The wind started picking up. Again the tone sounded, nearer, and the hairs on my arms stood straight up. Thunder rumbled overhead. The rain, a fitful drizzle most of the day, began to fall in chilly earnest. And again the hunting horn sounded. My heart started revving up, and I swallowed. Footsteps approached, and then Thomas was standing beside me, staring out the same way I was. Without speaking, he passed me the Winchester rifle and the ammunition belt.
"Is it?"
I asked him. His voice was rough.
"Yeah.
Damn it. How soon?"
"Soon.
Coming right through the heart of downtown."
"Fuck," I said.
Karen held both hands up.
"Wait, wait, the both of you. What the hell is happening?"
"The Wild Hunt is coming," I said, my throat dry. I sort of pissed off the Earl King a while back. He's not the kind of person to forget that."
"The King of Earls?" Karen asked. "Now who isn't making sense?"
"He's a powerful lord of Faerie," Thomas explained. "He's one of the leaders of the Wild Hunt. When the hunt comes to the real world, it starts hunting prey, and it doesn't stop. You can join it, you can hide from it, or you can die."
"Wait," Karen said. "Harry? They're hunting you?"
My heart continued to beat faster, pumping blood to my muscles, keying my body to run, run, run. It was hard to think past that and answer her question.
Yeah, I can... I think I can feel them coming."
I looked at Thomas.
"Water?"
"They'll run over it like it was solid ground."
"How do you know that?" Karen asked.
"I joined," Thomas said.
"Harry, Justine." I clenched my hands into fists on the heavy rifle.
"Get on the boat and go.
I'm not leaving you."
"Oh, yes you are," I said. "Wraith and Marcone have the other two sites covered, but we are the only ones left to get to Demon Reach. If we blow it there and the ritual goes off, we're all screwed. If I go with you, the hunt follows me and then goes after whoever is close. We'll never pull off an assault with them on our heels."
My brother ground his teeth and shook his head.
"Let's go, Harry," Karen said. "If they follow us out over the lake, we'll take them on."
"You can't take them on," I said quietly. "The hunt isn't a monster you can shoot. It's not some creature you can wrestle with, or some kind of mercenary you can buy off. It's a force of nature, red in tooth and claw. It kills, that's what it does."
"But," Karen began.
"He's right," Thomas said, his voice rough.
"Damn it, he's right."
"It's chess," I said quietly. "We've been checked with that ritual on the island. We have no choice but to try to stop it with everything we've got. If it means sacrificing a piece, that's how it has to be." I put a hand on my brother's shoulder. "Go, get it done." He put his cold, strong hand over mine for a second. Then he turned and ran for the boat. Karen stared up at me for a second, the rain plastering her hair down. Her face was twisted with agony.
"Harry, please," she swallowed. "I can't leave you alone, not twice."
"There are 8 million people in this city, and if we don't shut the ritual down, those people will die." Karen's expression changed from pain to shock, from shock to horror, and from horror to realization. She made a choking sound and ducked her head, her face turned away from me. Then she turned toward the boat. I watched her for a second longer. Then I sprinted for the Munstermobile as the haunting cry of the Wild Hunt's horn grew nearer. I jammed my key into the door lock and it wouldn't fit. I tried it again. No joy. Half-panicked, I ran to each of the others, but every single one of the locks was out of commission. I was going to bust out a window, but I checked the car's ignition through it first. It had been packed with what looked like chewing gum. The Munstermobile had been sabotaged, with gum and superglue. It was a trick I'd had Toot and company play on others more than once, and now what I had done unto others had been done unto me at the damnedest moment imaginable.
"Ah!" I screamed. "I hate ironic reversal!"
The Tsar Lord's guard had been escorting us along the way, but I hadn't said anything about staying on the job once we reached our destination. Given the distance I'd had them covering today, they probably dropped down exhausted the second I'd set the parking brake. The thunder rolled closer, my unthinking panic rose, and my wounded leg felt like it might burst into flames. My leg. My eyes widened with horror of my own. The Red Cap had killed me at that ambush, and I was only now realizing it. The trickle of blood flowing steadily from that tiny wound would leave a powerful olfactory and psychic trail behind me. Tracking me would be easier than whistling. I could run, but I couldn't hide. Thunder roared, and I saw a cluster of dim forms descend from the cloud cover overhead and into the city light of Chicago. I could run, but the hunt was moving at highway speeds. I wouldn't even be able to significantly delay the inevitable. Shadowy hounds rushed down at me from the north, along the shoreline, and behind them came a blurry cluster of dark figures on horseback, carrying bows and spears and long blades of every description. I couldn't beat the hunt, not even with Mab's roids in my system. But maybe. Then there was another roar, this time not of thunder, but of 140 horses, American-made. Karen Murphy's motorcycle slid to a stop, close enough to me to throw gravel over my shoes, and I turned to find her revving the engine.
"Karen, what the hell are you doing?"
"Get on the bike, bitch!" she called over the next horn blast. "Let's make them work for it." She smiled a fierce, bright smile, and I found my own face following her example. "Fuck yeah," I said, and threw myself onto the back of the Harley as darkness, death, and fire closed in around my city. Chapter 41. I dropped the cartridge belt for the Winchester over one shoulder and hurried to rake in the tail of my new duster before the motorcycle's rear wheel snagged it and killed me. I damn near fell off as Karen accelerated, but managed to cling to her waist with the arm holding the rifle. Karen scowled at me, grabbed the rifle from my hand, and slipped it down into a little section on the side of the Harley that fit the short rifle suspiciously well. I held on to her with a free hand, and with the other made sure my coat wouldn't get me killed.
"Which way?"
she shouted back to me.
"South, fast as you can."
She stomped one of her feet onto something, twisted a wrist, and the Harley, which had been doing around 50, leapt forward as if it hadn't been moving at all. I shot a quick glance over my shoulder and saw the nearest elements of the hunt begin to slowly fade back. I guess maybe the Wild Hunt hadn't ever heard about Harley Davidson. But she couldn't maintain the speed, not even on a wide Chicago street in chilly, rainy weather. There were just too many other people around, forcing her to weave between traffic, and she had to slow down to keep from splattering us all over some family's sedan. Indignant car horns began to blare as she slipped in and out of lanes, adding an abrasive harmony to the horns of the Wild Hunt.
"How we doing?" she called.
I looked back. The Wild Hunt was less than 100 yards away, and they didn't have to contend with traffic. The jerks were racing along 50 feet off the freaking ground, up in the dark and the rain, unseen by the vast majority of people going about their everyday business.
"They're cheating! Go faster! Head for the bush!"
Karen turned her head enough to catch me in the edge of her vision. "Is there a plan?"
"It isn't a very good plan," I shouted. "But I need a big open area for it to work, away from people." "In Chicago?"
she shouted. Then her eyes widened.
"The mills?"
"Go!" I shouted. Karen blitzed a red light, narrowly avoiding a left-turning car, and continued her furious rush down Lakeshore Drive. Chicago is a city of terrific demands. Demand for a military presence helped establish the early colonial-era forts, which in turn provided security for white settlers, traders, and missionaries. They built houses, churches, and businesses which accreted over time into a town, then a city. Chicago's position as the great crossroads of the emerging American nation meant that more and more people arrived, building more homes, businesses, and eventually, heavy-duty industry. By the end of the 19th century, Chicago was a booming industrial city, and its steel mills were nearly legendary. U.S. Steel, Youngstown Steel, Wisconsin Steel, Republic Steel, all thriving and growing on the shore of Lake Michigan, down by Calumet City. The lakefront in that entire area was sculpted to accommodate the steelworks, and much of the steel that would fuel the Allied efforts in two world wars was produced in that relatively tiny portion of the city. But all things wither away eventually. The American steel industry began to falter and fade, and by the end of the 20th century, all that remained of an ironmongery epicenter was a long stretch of industrial-strength wasteland and crumbling buildings on Lake Michigan's shore. A decade later, the city started trying to clean the place up, knocking down most of the buildings and structures. But here and there, stone and concrete ruins remained, like the bones of some vast beast that had been picked clean by scavengers. Nothing much grew there as the city around it thrived, just weeds and property values. That portion of the waterfront was slated for renewal, but it hadn't happened yet, and right now it was blasted heath, a flat, dark, empty, and desolate stretch of level land dotted with lonely reminders of former greatness. There was no shelter from rain or cold there, and on a miserable night like this there shouldn't be anyone hanging around. All we had to do was make it that far. We flew by the Museum of Science and Industry on our right, then flashed over the bridge above the 59th Street Yacht Harbor, moving into a section of road that had a little distance between itself and the nearest buildings, and a decided lack of foot traffic on a cold autumn evening. As if they'd been waiting for an opening away from so many prying eyes, the wild hunt swept down on us like a falcon diving onto a rabbit. But they were not attacking a rabbit. They were attacking a wabbit. A wascally wabbit. A wascally wabbit with a Winchester. Something that looked like a great gaunt hound made of smoke and cinders with glowing coals for eyes hit the ground just behind the Harley and began sprinting, keeping pace with us. It came rushing in, dark jaws spread to seize the back tire, the same motion it might have used had it been attempting to hamstring a fleeing deer. Mindless animal panic raged inside my head, but I kept it away from the core of my thoughts, forcing myself to focus, think, act. I saw Karen's eyes snap over to her rearview mirror as it closed, and felt her body tensing against mine as she prepared to evade to the left. I gathered my will, but waited to unleash it. And as the charhound closed within inches of the tire, Karen leaned and took the Harley left. The charhound's jaws clashed closed on exhaust fumes, and I unleashed my will from the palm of my outstretched right hand with a snarl of, "Forzare!" Force hit the charhound low on its front legs, and the beast's head went into the concrete at breakneck speed. Literally. There was a terrible snapping sound, and the charhound's limp body went tumbling end over end, bouncing up into the air for a dozen yards before landing, shedding wisps of darkness all the way. What landed in a boneless sprawl on the road was not a dog or a canine of any sort. It was a young man, a human, wearing a black t-shirt and torn old blue jeans. I barely had time to register that before the body tumbled off the road and was out of sight.
"Good shot!"
Karen cried, grinning fiercely. She was driving. She hadn't seen what was under the hound's outer shell. So that's how one joined the wild hunt. It was a mask. A huge, dark, terrifying mask. A masquerade. And I just killed a man.
I didn't get any time to feel angst over it.
Karen gunned the engine of the Harley, and it surged ahead, running along a spit of land that bifurcates Jackson Harbor. Even as she did, two riders descended, one on either side of the road, their steeds' hooves hammering against empty air about 5 feet up. Like the charhound, the steeds and riders were covered in a smoky darkness, through which shone the amber fire of their eyes. Karen saw the one on the right and tried to move left again, but the second rider pressed in closer, the dark horse's hooves nearly hammering onto our heads, and she wobbled and gunned the accelerator. I recognized another hunter's tactic. The first had forced us to close distance with the second. They were driving us between them, trying to make us panic and think about nothing but running straight ahead in a nice, smooth, predictable line. The second rider lifted an arm, and he held the dark shape of a spear in his hand.
He flung it forward, leading the target perfectly. I flung up my left hand, extending my shield spell. It got mixed results. The spear flew into it and through it, shredding my magic as it went. But instead of flying into my face, the spear was deflected just enough that its blade sliced across the back of my neck, leaving a line of burning pain behind it. The adrenaline was flowing and the pain didn't matter. Hell, it really didn't matter if the wound had opened an artery. It wasn't as though I could stop to get medical attention if it had. I twisted around to fling another bolt of force at the rider, but he lifted a hand and let out an eerie screech, and my attack was dispersed, doing little more than inconveniencing my target. His horse lost a step or two, but he dug black spurs into the beast's hide, and it soon made up the pace. Big surprise, magic wasn't a big threat to the huntsman. Solution? Winchester. I drew the rifle from the rack on the Harley, thumbed back the hammer while still holding it in one hand, then twisted at the waist to bring it to bear on the rider, the heavy weapon's forearm falling into my left hand. I didn't have much time to aim, and it might have actually been counterproductive given our speed, the irregularities of the chase, the darkness, and the rain. Plus, I'm not exactly Annie Oakley, so I made a best guess and pulled the trigger. The rifle let out a crack of thunder, and a burst of disintegrated shadow flew up from the shoulder and neck and jawline of the rider. I got a look at the armor beneath the mask and a portion of his face, and realized with renewed terror that I just put a bullet into the Earl King. And an instant later, I realized with a surge of incandescent hope that I'd just put a bullet into the Earl King on Halloween night. The Earl King reeled in the saddle, and his horse faltered and veered away, gaining altitude again. I levered a new round into the chamber, gripped the weapon like a pistol, and whirled it back over Karen's ducked head to point it one-handed at the rider on the right, who was even now making his own approach, spear uplifted. I guessed again and shot. I didn't hit him, but the thunder of the gun came just as he flung the spear. I didn't rattle the rider, but the flame-eyed horse flinched, and the spear flew wide of us. The rider was not deterred. He brought his steed under control first, then he let out a weird, bubbling screech and swept a long, dark-bladed sword from the scabbard at his side. He started closing the distance again. It was impossible to lever another round into the rifle quickly while riding behind Karen. That thing John Wayne does, whirling the rifle one-handed to cock it. It really helps if you have one of those enlarged, oblong lever handles to do it with, and mine was the smaller traditional rectangle. Also, it helps to be John Wayne. I had to draw the rifle into my chest and hold it steady with my left hand to get it done. The rider swerved in at us and I shot again, and missed as his steed juked and abruptly changed speed, briefly falling back before boring in again. I repeated that cycle 3 times before I realized that the rider was playing me for a sucker. He respected the gun, but knew its weakness. Me. He wasn't dodging bullets, he was dodging me. Tempting me into taking shots with little chance of success in an effort to get me to use up my ammo. And all the while, the rest of the hunt kept pace with us. Dozens of riders like this one, plus maybe twice that many shadowy hounds, all keeping about 50 yards back and up, clearly giving the first two hunters the honor of first attempt.
"His horse!"
Karen screamed.
"Shoot the horse!"
I ground my teeth. I didn't want to do that. For all I knew, that thing was only a horse costume. There could be another human being underneath that shadowy outer shell. The rider screeched again, the sound weirdly familiar and completely hair-raising. Again and again he came in on us, and I kept holding him off as we raced at insane speed through the rainy night, trading bullets for time.
"There!"
I shouted suddenly, pointing off to our left.
"Over there! The walls!"
We had reached the old steelwork grounds. Karen gunned the engine and swept the Harley out onto the open ground, racing frantically toward one of the only structures remaining, a trio of concrete walls maybe 30 or 40 feet high, running parallel to one another for at least a quarter of a mile,
the last remains of U.S. steel. As the steed's hooves started hitting the ground, they abruptly threw off clouds of angry silver sparks with every strike. The dark horse screeched in agony, and I let out a howl of defiance. After a century of labor in the steel mills, there had to be unreal levels of trace steel and iron in the ground where they had stood. And whatever power sustained the wild hunt didn't like it any more than the other beings of faery did.
"Between the walls!"
I shouted.
"Go! Go! Go!" "That's crazy!"
Karen shouted.
"I know!"
She guided the Harley around a pile of rubble and raced into the heavy shadows between two of the walls, and the rider was right on us as she did.
"Closer!"
I screamed.
"Force him to the wall!" "Why?"
A quarter of a mile goes by fast on a roaring Harley, and the only thing in front of us was the cold water of Lake Michigan.
"Hurry!"
I shrieked.
"Ah!"
Karen howled, and abruptly the Harley slowed and cut right. In an instant, we were even with the rider, and though no expression could show through the darkness surrounding his face, his body language was one of shock. "Now for the dangerous part," I thought, which made me start giggling. Now it was getting dangerous. Before the rider could change speed or take on altitude, and while the Harley was still leaning toward the rider, I hauled my left foot up onto the seat and sprang at him, still holding the now emptied Winchester in one hand. I slammed into the rider, but whoever he was strong. I had the power of the winter night at my disposal, but compared to the rider, my strength was that of a child. He threw a stiff arm into my chest and nearly sent me tumbling, but I grabbed onto his sleeve, and as he fell, I simply hung on. That changed things. It wasn't an issue of strength against strength. This made it a contest of mass and leverage versus muscle, and muscle lost. I dragged the rider from his saddle, and we both hit the rough ground at speed. My hand was torn from his arm on impact, and I remember trying to shield my head with my arms. The Winchester flew clear of me, too. I could see the rider tumbling as well, silver fire blowing up from the shadowy mask around him. I stopped tumbling yards later and frantically staggered back to my feet. I spotted the Winchester lying a few yards away and leapt for it. I grabbed the weapon, but before I could load it, I heard a footstep behind me and I spun, raising the gun up over my head parallel to the ground. It was in the nick of time. I felt the staggering power of an enormous blow, and a sword rang out against the steel of the Winchester's octagonal barrel. Kringle recovered from the block swiftly. Scraps of shadow mask hung from him, but he still wore the armor and a blood-red cloak and hood trimmed in white fur. His sword was silvery and unadorned, and he whipped it through a swift series of strikes. I blocked frantically with the Winchester, but I knew enough about fighting to know that I was utterly outclassed. He'd had that sword in me in a matter of seconds. So I ducked, sprang back from a backhanded slash, and raised the rifle to my shoulder as if I were about to shoot. That stopped him, forcing Kringle to twist to one side to avoid the theoretical bullet. And when he did, I slammed every bit of will I had into a lance of magical force.
"For Zari!"
Kringle slipped aside, incredibly nimble for a man his size, and the strike missed him completely. It did not miss the base of the ruined wall behind him. What must have been a couple of tons of aged concrete collapsed with a roar. Kringle was fast and skilled, but he wasn't perfect. He kept himself from being crushed, but several large stones clipped him and sent him staggering. I let out a primal scream and rushed him. I hit him at the shoulders, and he was too off balance to bring the sword into play. We both crashed to the ground, but I wound up on top, kneeling over him, gripping the steel barrel of the Winchester in both hands, holding it like a club. Kringle froze, staring up at me, and I suddenly realized that the night had gone utterly silent. I glanced around. The wild hunt had surrounded us, horses coming to a stop, their riders watching intently. Hounds paced nervously around at the horses' feet, but came no closer. The Earl King was there, too, his shadow mask tattered, greenish blood smearing the visible armor on his shoulder. His right arm hung limply. I turned back to Kringle. "Join, hide, or die," I growled. "Those are your options when the Wild Hunt comes for you." Kringle narrowed his eyes. "Everyone knows that's true." "Not anymore it isn't," I growled. I got to my feet, slowly, and just as slowly I lowered the rifle. Then I extended a hand to Kringle. "Tonight, the hunt is joining me." I swept my gaze around the silent assembly, filling it with all the steel and resolve I had. "I just put the Earl King on the bench and laid a beat down on freaking Santa Claus," I told them. "So you tell me, who's next? Who comes to make an end of the winter night, a peer of the winter court, and Mab's chosen? Who is at the top of this food chain? Because tonight is Halloween, and I am damn well not afraid of any of you." Firelight eyes stared at me from all around, and nothing stirred. Then Kringle's chuckle came rumbling out of his throat, a pulsating sound of deep and hearty mirth. One of his huge hands closed on mine, and I hauled him back to his feet. I glanced over at the Earl King as I did. I could see nothing of his face, but he nodded his head toward me very slightly. There was something ironic about the way he did it, and I sensed a kind of quiet amusement. There was a low rumble as the Harley came purring slowly over the ground toward us. Karen stared at the scene, her eyes wide, and drew the bike to a stop next to me. "Harry," she asked, "what just happened?" "A change of leadership," I said, and swung one leg over the Harley to hop up behind her. Even as I did, shadows began to whirl and slither. They crawled up Kringle's legs, restoring the concealing mask, and as they did, they also started climbing the Harley and both of the people sitting on it. It was a bizarre sensation. Everything about my physical perception sharpened, and I could suddenly sense the world around me with perfect clarity. I could feel the other members of the hunt, knew exactly where they were and what they were doing on sheer instinct, an instinct that guided them as well. The night brightened into a silvery fairyland that remained night while being as bright as the noonday sun. The shadow masks became something translucent so that if I peered closely enough, I could see what was behind it. I didn't do much peering. I had a feeling that I didn't want to know what was behind all of those shadows. Karen twisted the throttle on the Harley nervously, gunning the engine. But instead of a roar, it came out as a primal screech. The cry was instantly taken up by every single member of the hunt, even as Kringle, his shadow mask restored, remounted his steed and whirled it to face me. "Sir Knight," Kringle said, inclining his head slightly to me, "what game amuses you this fine, stormy evening?" I started loading shells from the ammo belt into the Winchester until the rifle was full again. Then I levered a shell into the pipe, slipped a replacement into the tube, shut the breech with a snap, and felt a wolfish smile spreading my mouth. "Tonight?" I asked. I raised my voice to address them all. "Tonight we hunt outsiders!" The bloodthirsty screech that went up from the Wild Hunt was deafening. Chapter 42.
"Pipe down!" I shouted. "We're going quiet until we get there."
The hunt settled down, though not instantly. Karen revved the Harley's engine, and it was completely, entirely silent. I could feel the vibration of the increased revolutions, but they did not translate into sound. The shadows around the Harley shifted and wavered, and after a second I realized that they had taken on a shape, that of an enormous black cat, muscled and solid, like a jaguar. That was astounding to me. Magic was not some kind of partially sentient force that did things of its own volition. It wasn't any more artistic than electricity.
Okay, I said to Karen. Let's move.
She asked without turning her head. Move where?
The island, I said.
Harry, this is a motorcycle.
It'll work, I said. Look at it.
Karen jerked as she noted the appearance of the Harley.
You want me to drive into the lake?
You have to admit, I said, it isn't the craziest thing I've ever asked you to do. It isn't even the craziest thing I've asked you to do tonight. Karen thought about that one for a second and said,
You're right. Let's go.
She dropped the Harley into gear, threw out a rooster tail of dirt and gravel, and we rushed toward the shore of the lake. The steel mills had been engaged in actual shipping traffic in their day, and the level field of construction marched right up to the water's edge and dropped off abruptly, the water 4 or 5 feet straight down. Karen gunned the engine, covering the last 200 yards in a flat-out sprint, and the torque on that Harley's engine was something epic, its bellow too loud to be wholly contained by the shadow mask, emerging from the shadow tiger's mouth as a deep-throated roar. Karen let out a scream that was 2 parts excitement to 1 part terror, and we flew 20 feet before the tires crashed down onto the surface of the lake and held. The bike jounced a couple of times, but I held on to Karen and kept from flying off. It was an interesting question, though. If I had, would the water have supported me, like an endless field of asphalt? Or would it have behaved as it normally would? The entire hunt swept along behind us, silent but for the low thunder of hooves and the panting of the hounds, when suddenly the silver starlight turned bright azure blue.
Whoa, Karen said. Did you do that?
I don't think so, I said. I looked over my shoulder and found Kringle and the Earl King riding along behind me. I jerked my head at them in a beckoning gesture, and they obligingly came up on either side of the Harley Tiger.
"What is that?"
I asked, pointing at the sky.
"A temporal pressure wave,"
the Earl King said, his flaming eyes narrowed.
"A what?" I asked.
The Earl King looked at Kringle.
"This is your area of expertise. Explain it."
"Someone is bending time against us," Kringle said.
I stared at him for a second, and then it clicked. "We're being rushed forward so that we'll get there too late," I said. "We're looking at a Doppler shift."
"Is what he said correct?" the Earl King asked Kringle curiously. "Essentially, we've already lost half an hour by my count."
"Who could have done this?" I asked.
"You have encountered this before, wizard," Kringle said. "Can you not guess?"
"One of the queens," I muttered. "Or someone operating on their level. Can we get out of this wave?" The Earl King and Kringle traded a look.
"You are the leader of the hunt," Kringle said. "What you write with your power will grace each of us. Would you like to do it?"
Was he kidding me? I had almost as much of an idea of how to screw around with the fabric of time as I did which of my clothes could be safely washed in hot water.
"I probably need to save myself for what's coming," I said.
Kringle nodded.
"If it is your will," he said diffidently, "we can set our hands against it."
"Do it," I said. They both nodded their heads at me in small bows, and then their steeds raced out in front of the pack. Sparks began to fly from their horses' hooves, first blue, then abruptly darkening to scarlet. The air seemed to shimmer, and strange, twisted sounds writhed all around us. Then there was a reverberating crash that sounded like something between thunder and the discharge of a blaster. The air split in front of the two of them like a curtain, and as the hunt hurtled through it, the stars washed out to their normal silver hue again.
"Well done, I guess," I shouted,
and then I noticed that Kringle was no longer there, though the Earl King still raced along. Over the next few moments, he slowed enough to pace Karen and me.
"Hey, where'd Bowl Full of Jelly go?"
"Kringle was our stepping stone out of the rapids of the stream," he called back. "To lift us out, he had to remain behind.
He will rejoin us farther down the shore.
Harry, Karen said.
How much farther down the shore?
The Earl King shrugged with his uninjured arm.
Time may hold no terror for us immortals, Sir Knight, but it is a massive force, all but beyond even our control. It will take as long as it takes.
Harry,
Karen snapped. I turned my eyes front and felt them widen. We had arrived at Demon Reach, and the island was under attack. The first thing I saw was the curtain wall around the island's shoreline. It was nothing but a flicker of opalescent light, like a dense aurora borealis, stretching from the water's edge up into the October sky. It cast an eerie glow over the trees of the island, steeping them in menacing black shadow, and its reflection in the waters of the lake was 3 or 4 times bigger and more colorful than it should have been. As the hunt rushed closer, I could make out other details, too. There was a small fleet of boats surrounding the island. It looked like something out of World War II's Pacific Theater. Some of the boats were modest recreational models, several at least the size of the water beetle, and 3 looked like tugboat barge units, the kind that could ferry 20 loaded train cars around the lake. I could see motion in the waters around the shore. Things were swarming up out of the lake, hideous and fascinating, hundreds of them. They smashed into Demon Reach's curtain wall. Lights pulsed in liquid concentric circles where they touched it, and shrieks of alien agony stretched the air toward a breaking point. The waters within 20 feet of the shore bubbled and thrashed in a demonic frenzy. I felt a pulse of power stir in the air, and a bolt of sickly green energy lashed across the waters and slammed into the curtain wall. The entire wall dimmed for a second, but then resurged as the island resisted the attack. I tracked the bolt back to the barge and saw a figure in a weird, writhing cloak standing on the deck facing the island. Shark face. As I watched, I saw a Zodiac boat carrying a team of 8 men in dark clothing rush in toward the shore. The man in the nose of the boat lifted something to his shoulder. There was a loud phoomp, and a fire blossomed in the brush, burning with an eye-searing chemical brilliance. Then the Zodiac whirled and rushed back out again, as if to escape a counterstrike, or maybe they just didn't want to stay anywhere close to waters full of piranha-like frenzied outsiders while sitting in a rubber boat. 6 other boats were doing the same thing, and several other similar craft were sitting still, full of armed men waiting silently for the chance to land on shore. I stared in shock. The recent rain meant that the island wasn't likely to burst into flame anytime soon, but I had utterly underestimated the scope of tonight's conflict. Ye gods and little fishes, this wasn't just a ritual spell. This was an all-out amphibious assault, my very own miniature war. Earl King, I said, can you veil the hunt, please? The Earl King glanced at me, then back at the hunt, and suddenly the cold, weirdly flat-sounding dimness of a veil against both sight and sound gathered around us like a cloud. This doesn't make any sense, I said. The ritual would still need a platform, and that would take time and work to set up, at least a day. It would show. They haven't even gotten onto the island yet. Then the truth hit me in a flash. The barges, I said. They set up a ritual platform on one of the barges. It's the only thing that makes sense. The waters of the lake would diminish the power they could draw from the ley lines running beneath it, the Earl King said. Yeah, I said. That's why they're assaulting the shore. They're going to force a breach and then run the barge aground on the island. That'll put them in direct contact with the ley line.
There are many outsiders here, Sir Knight, he noted. More than enough to do battle with the hunt if we become bogged down in their numbers. They will react to us as one beast once they know the danger we pose to them. Have a care for where we enter the fray. We'd better make the first punch count, I said. 3 barges. Which one has the platform?
Why assume there's only one? Karen asked.
If it was me, I'd set the spell upon all three of them for redundancy.
They might have set the spell up on all three of them for redundancy, I said. She drove one of her elbows back against my stomach, lightly. We start this by sinking a barge, I decided. Then I blinked and looked at the Earl King. Can we sink a barge?
The shadow-masked Earl King tilted his head slightly to one side, his burning eyes narrowed.
Wizard, please.
Right, I said. Sorry. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a shark face by the toe. I pointed at the barge in the middle, where I'd seen the outsider a moment ago. That one. And once it's down, we'll split into two groups. You'll lead half the hunt for the barge on the far side, and I'll take my half to the nearer one. If we can nix any possibility of the ritual happening, maybe they'll call it a night and go home.
That seems unlikely, said the Earl King.
He slowly flexed the arm I'd shot him in,
and I could sense that, while it was not comfortable, the Lord of the Goblins was already functionally recovered from the injury.
Never know until you try, I said.
I looked back at the hunt and pointed toward the center barge. I repeated my instructions to them, and soot-black hands drew dozens of shadowy weapons. I leaned into Karen a little and said next to her ear, You ready for this?
Only a lunatic is ready for this, she said.
I could hear her smile as she spoke. Then she turned her head and, before I could react, planted a kiss right on my mouth. I almost fell off the Harley. She drew her head back, flashed me a wicked little smile, and said,
For luck, Star Wars style. You are so hot right now, I told her.
I lifted my Winchester overhead, then dropped it to point forward, and the hunt surged ahead at its full, insane speed, silent and unseen and inevitable.
Go right past its rear end, I told Murphy.
You mean its stern?
Yes, that, I said, rolling my eyes, and then I began to gather in my will. It was hard, a slow and heavy strain, like trying to breathe through layers of heavy cloth. It was like holding a fistful of sand. Every bit of energy I drew in wanted to slip away from me, and the harder I tried to hold it, the more trickled through my fingers. So I gritted my teeth, accepted that I wasn't going to have a lot of energy to work with, and tried to hold it loosely, gently, as we closed in on the barge. We were the first to pass it, and as we did, I flung out my hand, crying out,
For Zari!
Raw will leapt through the air, shattering our concealing veil. The energy was focused into the shape of a cone, needle-pointed at the top, and widening gradually to about 6 inches across, an invisible lance. I couldn't have done any more with the limited energy I had at my disposal. It hit the hull of the barge with a clang and a shriek of tearing metal, and then we were past it, and Karen was tugging the Harley into a tight, leaning turn. I checked over my shoulder and saw the Earl King, his sword in hand, lean over the saddle and strike. There was a hissing sound and a howl of screeching steel, and, starting at the hole I'd punched in the barge's hull, a straight line of red-hot metal appeared where his sword had simply sheared through it. Behind him the next riders struck, their weapons carving steel like soft pine, slashing at the weakened section and tearing the original hole I'd made wider and wider. I heard a howl of rage and looked up on the deck of the barge to see Shark Face there, already gathering energy to hurl at the riders of the hunt. He didn't take the hounds into consideration. Before he could unleash his power, a dozen of the beasts hit him, all together, in a single psychotic canine wave. Since they were running fast enough to get themselves a speeding ticket in most of Illinois, the impact was formidable. Hounds and outsider alike flew out over the rails of the barge and vanished into the waters of Lake Michigan. And somehow, I knew, the fight continued beneath its waves. The Earl King let out a shriek of encouragement, one that was echoed by the other riders as the tail end of the column passed the barge. As the last rider struck, a column of eerie green fire rose up from the glowing edges of the shredded steel hull, and with a groan of strained seams, the barge started to list badly to the right, starboard, I guess, as water rushed in through the hole the Hunt had made. Karen had already wheeled the Harley into a snarling turn, one that let us see the deck of the ship as it began to sink.